Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get a premium finish with less odor and fumes for your painting project with Rust-Oleum's Low Odor Spray Paint. It provides a long-lasting, durable finish, making it perfect for indoor or outdoor projects. Save big on Rust-Oleum Spray Paints now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big.
Hi, everyone. Today is going to be completely different from our other recordings because I am flying solo. We have had problems with our software that we use to record our episodes, and I think Nina is actually on strike today. So I figured instead of making you guys wait, I would try something different. So let's jump right in. This week's question is from David, and it's about the Blackfriars Massacre episode. What happened to Urardi and Italiano after they were cleared of the massacre due to an inept investigation? Nina answered briefly on YouTube, but our listeners who are on other platforms would probably like to hear the answer also. Urardi was arrested on earlier charges that he had committed an armored car heist in Dallas in September of 1979. The authorities tried to claim that recent fingerprints taken from him matched ones they had taken from an apartment in Dallas in 1979. But Urardi's lawyer argued successfully that the match was bogus and that Urardi had never, ever traveled to Texas in his life. And that is completely insane and absolutely railroading. And it wasn't over for Urardi. He was picked up again a few months later in a racketeering sweep, but the charges were dropped. Along the way, he turned his life around, spending his last years working in a halfway house before passing away in 2001. And I'm happy to say that Italiano stayed clear of law enforcement for the rest of his life and passed away of natural causes in 2006. So a good ending for both of them. And that brings us to some of the other men who weren't so lucky that I'll be talking about today. 78 in Boston was no less violent than the previous years had been. According to the Boston Police Department website, 26 of those homicides, including the five victims from the Blackfriars Massacre, are still unsolved as of today. And I won't just be discussing Boston homicide victims today. Three of the men I'll be talking about were killed in Rhode Island and one in New York that was deemed a suicide. Two of those men, Edward Bassett and George Basmajian, Nina and I spoke about a couple of weeks ago in the hit parade of 1977. As promised, today I'm going to go deeper into Basmajian and Bassett. I'll try to go in chronological order, but I don't know. 21-year-old Vincent Alexander was shot to death outside a barroom on the corner of Friend and Causeway Street on the evening of February 25th. The man who was arrested for the murder was Thomas Casale, who was out on $1,000 bail for killing Robert McFarland, who had been shot to death while helping a friend move back in November the prior year. If you want to hear more about that case, I will try to remember to put the link in the show notes for you. Vincent had been shot with a .38 revolver, which was the same caliber weapon found in the hallway of Casale's building. But that wasn't enough to get an indictment against Casale, and the murder of Vincent Alexander is still an open case as of today. And I want to mention that Vincent had no record prior to his murder. The following month, on March 19th, Ibrantino Chico Brito Jr. was killed in Cranston, Rhode Island. The Cape Verde native and Vietnam vet did have a record going back to 1969 when he was charged with assault with intent to kill after a domestic dispute at the home of Pauline LaForest of Woonsocket. 10 months later, he and another man were arrested for assault and robbing a man of $15. The charges were dropped in the domestic dispute case, but he was convicted on the assault and robbery charges and sentenced to a year in jail. In January of 1975, he and another man had their throats slashed with a broken bottle in a barroom brawl in Steuben's Cafe in Providence. A little over a year later, in March of 76, he was arrested for possessing an unlicensed handgun. Once again, he was given a year sentence in the ACI. Then just 2 years later, he was found shot to death in a blue Ford van that was parked in front of 44 Navajo Street in Cranston on the town line with Providence at 3:30 p.m. The police described the murder as a gangland slaying, saying it had appeared that Brito was killed elsewhere than brought to the location. He had been shot 5 times in the back and once in the head. The van had been stolen in Providence that past December, and the plates were stolen all the way back in 1975. The last time anyone had seen him alive was on March 16th when he left his home alone in his own car around 10 5:30 in the morning. Brito's homicide was the 18th in Rhode Island that year. No one was ever charged with Brito's slaying, and that brings me to the next victim, Joseph P. Joe Onions Scanlon, who was killed on April 2nd. And he was called Joe Onions because supposedly he made all the girls cry because he was a heartbreaker. Scanlon had a difficult childhood growing up in Hartford, Connecticut's South End neighborhood, which in those days was predominantly Italian-American, blue-collar, with neat houses and nice landscaping and a lot of little shops owned and operated by locals. His father was Irish and his mom Italian, and he was the only boy out of the four kids. Dad ditched while he was very young, leaving his mom to struggle to raise the foursome on her own. The charming, personable, and not so hard on the eye Scanlon became a short-order cook, but dreamt of being in the mafia, so he packed up his things and moved to Providence, even adopting an alias that sounded more Italian, at least to him, Scaloni. Scanlon was preparing himself for the big leagues, evidently, while he was still in Connecticut. As a teenager, he was pinched for B&Es, holdups, and larceny. In August 1974, he was arrested at gunpoint while hiding out in the second-floor bedroom of his girlfriend's apartment. He was on the lam after robbing a Hartford, Connecticut gas station. During the robbery, he threatened to kill the teenage attendant and slapped him around before fleeing with a roughly $1,000 deposit. In June the following year, Scanlon and his girlfriend robbed another local business. Scanlon was given a 30-day sentence, and his girlfriend was given a 15-day sentence. Still not rehabilitated, the duo were charged with stealing a refrigerator and a stove from the apartment they had lived in before moving to Hartford in March of 76. And not long after that, Joe Onions and his girlfriend made their way to Providence, Rhode Island. In September of 77, he carjacked a vehicle and forced two men to drive around Providence. And I don't know how and why all that went down, but around 3 o'clock in the morning, a policeman saw him getting out of the vehicle and the gun sticking out of his belt. The police officer identified himself, and Scanlon ditched the gun over a fence and took off, but he didn't make it very far. He was charged with 2 counts of assault and 3 weapons charges. It would be several months later that Joe Onions became an informant for the Providence Police Department, providing them information on Andrew F. Marola and Nicholas Parry. And speaking of Andrew Marola, aka Andino Marola, he was named after his late uncle, Andino Marola. Longtime listeners might recall that Andino Marola was murdered after participating in the Fall River mail robbery in January of 1935. According to the authorities at the time, Marola was killed by his associates after he had been seen talking to the postal inspectors. Andino/Andrew was born just 5 months after his uncle's murder, and it's ironic considering how the case ends up playing out that he himself ends up killing an informant. Nicholas Parry owned the Federal House Discount, a forerunner to the dollar store, which was located at 161 Atwells Ave across the street from the Coin-O-Matic. According to the FBI, Raymond Patriaca was using a backroom apartment at Parry's to conduct mafia business, including planning robberies and murders. The murders of both Gerald Christie and Joe Scanlon were allegedly planned in that very room. Andrew Marola owned Club 21 on Knight Street, and it was there that Scanlon was murdered on April 2nd, 1978. At the end of the year, authorities would dig up the floor of the club, hoping to find Joe's body, but to no avail. As I mentioned before, Joe had begun informing on Parry and Marola in the months leading up to his slaying. I believe he told the cops about the Cumberland Coin Shop robbery, which took place on October 17th, 1977, in Woonsocket, and was pulled off by 3 men. That score was reportedly fenced in New York. Then just 8 days before Scanlon's murder, EKRU Jewelry in Providence was robbed and also fenced to New York. So it's Nina's theory, and mine, that one of the perpetrators was Scanlon. But before charges could be brought, Parry and Marola got wind of his cooperation with the police. Marola and Parry were arrested on January 10th, 1979, and charged with Scanlon's murder. But there was still nobody to present as evidence. However, they had an eyewitness, Scanlon's longtime girlfriend and former partner in crime, Sandra Surprise. And I'm sure it was a surprise for Parry and Marola. She testified that she watched Parry punch Joe in the face to distract him while Marola put one round in the back of his head. She was holding their 3-month-old baby while she stood silent and witnessed the murder of her boyfriend. The authorities were also on the hunt for a third participant. Late April of 79, a newspaper in Hartford, Connecticut reported reported a car crash involving a lone driver named Edwin DeFranzo. According to the police, DeFranzo was driving when he suddenly veered off the road and hit the guardrails and rode them for 88 feet before his car flipped over and landed on its roof. DeFranzo survived with minor injuries. Then 6 weeks later, DeFranzo was arrested at the YMCA in Torrington, Connecticut, and charged with participating in Scanlon's murder. DeFranzo allegedly hid out at Thomas Ciracola's house in Revere Beach sometime between the Scanlon murder and the double homicide of Ciracola and Anthony Russo at the same house in February of 79. DeFranzo agreed to become a witness to the prosecution and testify that he had helped Marola clean up the evidence at the crime scene, but he was unable to lead the authorities to where the body was buried. Marola and Pari were convicted despite Scanlon's still missing remains. The duo appealed their convictions, but in 1982, they pleaded no contest in exchange for reduced charges. The agreement included an admission that they had deposited Scanlon's body in the Narragansett Bay, although nobody really believed that claim. It would be another 26 years before Joe Onions could be laid to rest. Stricken with cancer, Pari made a deathbed confession and led authorities to Scanlon's burial site. He told how he used a backhoe to inter Joe's remains behind an apartment complex in Riverside, which at the time was under construction. 30 years later, another backhoe was used to recover his remains while Pari sat nearby in his wheelchair, instructing the crew where to dig. As they dug down deeper, a low-cut brown boot that matched the description of the shoes that Joe had been wearing on his last day fell from the scoop of the backhoe. The digging was halted and the state's forensic team searched by hand, recovering his jacket and bones. A DNA test confirmed the match, and that is the end of Joe Onion's story. April of 1978 saw more than a handful of murders. There was one other in Rhode Island and at least seven in the Boston area. I want to briefly talk about the slaying of Joseph Cardinale. The 39-year-old had been the owner of the Airway Cafe in East Boston for 17 years. The bar was located at 202 Maverick Street, and it was there that he was murdered on April 7th. His body was found lying face down on the floor on the customer side of the bar room at 10:30 a.m. by a patron. The door to the bar had been left unlocked. Someone had shot him twice in the head, and there was no sign of a robbery. Back in September of 75, the bar room was allegedly firebombed, according to the fire inspectors. The fire spread to the Cardinale family apartment located directly above the establishment and one other apartment occupied by another family. The tenants escaped unharmed, and the Cardinales were away at the time. The Cardinale slaying remains an unsolved homicide. And there were three other murders in the surrounding area in just 14 hours. A man was stabbed to death in a Malden hotel during an argument. Another man was shot in the stomach with a shotgun and killed in Milton. And a third man who worked for the city of Revere was shot twice in the head, his body left in a stolen vehicle that was parked in Chelsea and then set on fire. In my memory, it seems like Chelsea always had a car fire in the 70s. Maybe I'm just hallucinating that. Another slaying took place in East Boston on April 11th. Mark Burns of Charlestown was shot to death at the rear of 21 Trenton Street. Like Cardinale, the case remains open. And now for Elliot Bassett, who we briefly covered in part 3 of the Hit Parade of 1977. He fell to his death from a New York City hotel room on April 26, 78, days before he was due to stand trial for narcotic smuggling. There were five major drug raids in Rhode Island in August of 1977, which netted some 8 tons of Colombian marijuana. In total, 32 people were arrested, including Bassett. The coroner ruled his death a suicide, but he was in cahoots with some very unsavory characters, and they paid him a visit not long before the fall. They were Jerry Tillinghast and George Basmagian. George would turn up dead a few months later after Bassett's demise. Zarleta was also tied to Bassett. He was killed in late 1977. Basmagian's body would be found in the same vicinity as Leda just 11 months after. The following month, Linda Chaplin fell from a 10th-story window in New York City. She was the fifth person connected to the smuggling ring to meet an untimely death. Her name was among 200 in an address book belonging to David A. Jeffrey. He met his end the year prior in July when the vehicle he was driving, which was owned by Theodore Brown, another defendant, was destroyed by a bulldozer. Also listed in that address book was James Scott Harvey, who was allegedly a pilot for the same smugglers. He drowned in front of hundreds of beachgoers in Fort Lauderdale when his single-engine plane crashed into the ocean. And even Bassett's own brother, who OD'd at a Hojo's in Warwick, was listed in the address book. As for Elliot, his estate went after the state of Rhode Island for a total of $196,000, which included the bail money that was posted the year before. The smuggling case moved forward without Bassett and led to the convictions of seven men. Back to Massachusetts. On October 20th, 46-year-old Joseph DeRusso Jr. was shot to death on Causeway Street in Boston, not far from where the first victim of the year, Vincent Alexander, was killed. DeRusso had a record for petty crimes going back to his teens. He graduated from robbing candy stores to gas stations by the mid-1950s. At the time of his slaying, he was out on bail for assault and battery charges. A month after making bail, just before 4 a.m. in the morning, witnesses said they saw three men scuffling, then heard four gunshots, followed by two men fleeing in a taxi. DeRusso was found between two parked cars, having been shot in the face and neck with a .38 caliber revolver. Police found the same caliber revolver behind a nearby building, but the discovery stopped there. No one was ever charged with the murder. The following month, Joseph DeFranzo was shot to death on November 4th at 333 Hanover Street, just a short walk from where DeRusso was killed. His brother was killed the year before, and they had been trying to kill Joey most likely since that day. First, he was stabbed multiple times and spent weeks in the hospital. Just a month after he finished convalescing, he was shot five times, including two rounds to the head on the corner of Hanover and Richmond Street in broad daylight. There were over 200 people out, and no one saw a thing. Thinking that he was going to pack it in, DeFranzo told the cops that while he was lying on the sidewalk, he saw the owner of the pizza shop come out, scoop up his .45 with a towel, hightail it back to the shop, and put up the clothes sign. He then told the cops who his assailants were, but when Joey found out that he was going to make it, he retracted his confession. So they subpoenaed him for the grand jury hearing in order to indict his attackers, but Joey claimed amnesia due to his head wounds. But just like his brother, Jackie, he had robbed from the wrong people and it wasn't going to be forgiven. So while his mother was en masse less than 100 feet away, Joey was shot to death on the corner of Prince and Hanover Street, this time with some 300 people out and about, and still not a single witness. I need to jump out of order here. The last weekend of November, Stephen Matarazzo walked into Cafe Felix armed with a .45 and a knife, supposedly to avenge Joey and Jackie's murders. A struggle ensued. Matarazzo was disarmed, beaten and dragged into the street, then was repeatedly stabbed as his assailants dragged him up Richmond Street before leaving him for dead in front of number 108. He was discovered sitting on the stoop, still alive. He succumbed to his wounds later that morning at the hospital, and again, not a single witness. While Joey's murder remains unsolved this day, in spite of everyone knowing who his assailants were, a warrant had been issued for the arrest of Vincent Federico, who had taken it on the lam. Rapper Corleto would try to avenge Matarazzo's murder the following summer, and he too would meet the same end. We'll cover more about that when we do the hit parade of 1979. On November 11th, Joseph Patrizzi was found shot five times in the head in the parking lot of the Sons of Italy in Revere, Mass. Patrizzi had been born in Lynn, Mass. In October of 1940 to Joseph and Helen Patrizzi. He was the second child and oldest son. His younger brother, Angelo, was born in January of 43. Angelo would meet his tragic end in 1981, allegedly at the hands of the same men who killed Joe. Their childhood wasn't an easy one. Helen Patrizzi filed for divorce in January 46 and got custody of all three kids. Both Helen and Joe Sr. remarried shortly thereafter. In December of 64, Roy French, one of the men convicted of slaying Teddy Deegan, and Joe were indicted on charges that they robbed a bank in Linfield for over $11,000 in mid-September of that year. French was arrested in his home in Everett, but Joe was already in Concord on charges of assault and battery. The bank teller identified Patrizzi as one of the holdup men, but after a three-week trial in February of 66, the duo was exonerated. In January of 72, Patrizzi was dropped off and abandoned at the Grover Manor Hospital in Revere with a bullet wound in his abdomen. After emergency surgery, he was transferred to Mass General and placed on the danger list. Earlier that evening, another man named Arthur Fournier had been shot six times by three attackers at his office in Charlestown. He claimed that he had shot one of his assailants in the abdomen, but the authorities were reluctant to try to link the two incidents together, but we assume that Patrizzi was the man who was trying to rob Fournier. Fast forward to August of 1974, when Patrizzi was arrested along with Skinny Cazonis and three others in an alleged loan sharking scheme. Nina and I covered a lot of that case in Not Your Average Joe. So if you want to hear more about that, you can listen to that episode. Hopefully I will remember to link it. The following week, with Joe Bolero representing Patrizzi and Cazonis and the other three men, they pleaded not guilty and were all released on bail. A year later, Patrizzi and three of his co-defendants pleaded guilty. Cazonis remained on trial and was found guilty on two counts the following week. He was sentenced to 8 years in federal prison, but released pending appeal. Patrizzi, meanwhile, received a five-year sentence for his plea agreement. He had recently been freed and was working at Al's Surf Auto Body in Revere as part of a work release program when he was killed. The following month, the Revere police found Patrizzi's body lying across the front seat of a stolen Dodge. It was parked in front of the Sons of Italy, as I mentioned earlier. He was wearing a ski mask and dark clothes. There were two visible entry wounds, one above the left eye and one behind the left ear. And the slaying of Patrizzi remains unsolved. Nina and I had been talking about it was likely that they lured him in with the temptation of a score, hence why he was wearing the ski mask and the dark clothes. Now I can wrap it up with the murder of George A. Basmagian, aka George Lombardi. Like Scanlon, I guess George wanted to sound more Italian, although he was half Italian. On November 30th, George was shot 9 times at close range. His body was recovered just moments after he was slain. So soon, in fact, that he was still bleeding out from the wounds when the cops found him. The reason for the quick discovery was that the authorities had Basmagian and the Tillinghast brothers under surveillance. They were suspects in multiple murders, including three in 1977 alone. A task force that included both the feds and Rhode Island State Police had been tailing them for some 5+ hours when they lost them momentarily not far from the TF Green Airport and near the location where Cesar Leyda's body had been found just 1 year earlier. Several minutes passed before one of the teams happened upon the stolen Mercury sedan that was parked behind the National Car Rental Agency. The windows were steamed up, but they could see the 6'1", 220-pound Basmagian sprawled across the back seat with his head positioned behind the driver's seat. The alleged bodyguard of Jerry Wimette and partner in crime with the Tillinghasts was no more. The Stadies made a beeline to St. Rocco Society Club in Cranston, where Tillinghast and other wise guys were known to frequent. The duo was seated at a table together. They were searched and taken into custody. The motive was said to be that they weren't willing to take a chance that Basmagian wouldn't flip, as things were heating up with both the drug smuggling cases and the murder investigations. The following summer, the case went to trial. One piece of the government's case against the brothers, besides almost being caught red-handed, was their license plate scheme. During the 5+ hours of surveillance prior to Basmagian slaying, the Stady had read the license plate number of the Mercury. But when the car was found, it had a different license plate attached. The boys borrowed the first plate from a car dealer, who of course landed in hot water. But before taking off, they swapped the plate for a stolen one. And that obviously didn't help them cover their tracks. The brothers were convicted of murder, which in Rhode Island carried a minimum mandatory sentence of life. But as we know, life doesn't always mean life in prison cases. And that is where I'm going to wrap it up today. Guys, thank you for bearing with me. It's tough talking to myself, but I wanted to get this done. Next week, Howie Winter and the race-fixing case, finally. Thanks, everyone. Bye.